clearing deeper in was a rocky alcove where someone could hide and watch the opening. "One of us will hide here," he said, facing them. "When our friend from the Skatalo comes through that opening, the tar gets thrown at it. The leaves will split on impact, so the tar will go all over. It will take the creature a moment or two at least to figure out what happened. By then, we'll be heading for the airship." Tagwin actually laughed. "That is a terrible plan, young Pandaren. I suppose you believe that you should be the one who throws the tar, don't you?"
"Tagwin has a point," Kyber agreed quickly. "Your plan won't work."
Pen glowered at her. "Why not? What's wrong with it?" The elven girl held his angry gaze.
"In the first place, we have already established that you are the one individual who is indispensable to the success of the search for the Ard Ris, so you can't be put at risk. In the second place, you are the only one who can fly the airship, so you have to get aboard if we're to fly out of here. In the third place, we still don't know what this thing is. We don't know if it's human or not. We don't know if it has the use of magic. That's too many variables for you to deal with. I'm the one who has the elf stones. I also have a modicum of magic I can call upon if I need to. I'm faster than you are on foot. I'm expendable. I have to be the one who confronts it."
"If you miss," Tagwin said darkly, "you had better be fast indeed."
"All the more reason why you and Pen have to be moving toward the Skatalo the moment it enters the rocks. You have to be airborne before it can recover and decide it has been tricked, whatever the result of my efforts. If it gets back through that maze and out into the meadow before you board and cut the lines, we're dead."
There was a long silence as they considered the chances of this happening. Pen shook his head. "What if it brings Cinnaminson into the rocks with it?" Kyber stared at him without answering. She didn't need to tell him what he already knew.
"I don't like it," Tagwin growled. "I don't like any of it."
But the matter was decided. Chapter 4. Night descended across the rugged slopes of the Charnels like a silky black curtain pricked by a thousand silver needles. The clarity of the sky was stunning, a brilliant wash of light that gave visibility for miles from where Kyber Elysadil sat staring northward in the company of Pandaren and Tagwin. The purity of the mountain air was in sharp contrast to the murkiness of an Acheray on the Lazarene, or even to Sionid's storm-washed isolation on the Innisbor. There was a hushed quality to the darkness, the sounds of the world left far below on the hilltops and grasslands, unable to rise so high or penetrate so deeply. Here she felt soothed and comforted. Here, rebirth of the sort that the world always needed was possible. They had done what they could to prepare for the Skatalo's appearance. They had built their fire, a bright flicker of orange, just below where they sat hiding, feeding it sufficient wood so that it would burn for hours before it needed replenishing. They had placed the tar ball close enough to protect it from the cold so that it would stay sticky inside its leafy wrapping. They had built their straw men, scarecrows made of debris and covered with their cloaks. They had spent time working on the look of them, on the setting of positions, placing them just far enough away so as not to be immediately recognizable for what they really were, but close enough to suggest the possibility of sleeping travelers. They had done this before the sun had disappeared into the hills west, before twilight faded and darkness arrived. They had studied all the possible routes of approach and escape, marked well the path from where they hid to where the fire burned, and from where they hid to where the tree line would lead them back to the meadow. They were as ready, she supposed, as they were ever going to be. She wished they could do more, but they had done all they could think to do and would have to be content with that. The plan was unchanged, save for one aspect.
Instead of hiding down in the rocks ahead of time, she was waiting with Pen and Tagwin until the Skatalo made her approach. That way, she would know better when to make ready. Her plan was simple. Wait for the creature to appear, toss the tar from her hiding place in the rocks, and run. By then, Pen and Tagwin would already be aboard the Skatalo and flying to meet her. If they were unable to land again, they would simply drop her a line and whisk her away. It all sounded simple. But she was already having her doubts. For one thing, the tar ball was heavy and unwieldy. It was going to take a mighty throw to get it to fly more than 20 feet. That meant letting their hunter get awfully close. And it was going to be difficult to be accurate. The tar was squishy and crudely formed. It wasn't going to be like throwing a rock or a wooden ball. She was also thinking back to how fast the creature had moved along the rooftops of an atcheray, and she didn't think she could outrun it if the tar didn't slow it down. Of course, she would use her druid skills to help in the effort, an implementation of a little magic to help with speed and direction and control. But her skills were untested for the most part, and never in circumstances as dire as these. She would have to get everything right. She sighed wearily. It didn't do much good to think about those things because she knew she couldn't change any of them. Most plans involved an element of luck. She was going to have to hope she had a lot of it with this one. She listened to the breathing of her companions in the stillness, to the soft scrape of their boots on the rocks as they shifted position. Pen was lying down, and Tagwin was sitting with his head between his knees. Both were dozing. She didn't blame them. It was nearing midnight, and there had been no sign of the airship. She was beginning to think that it had gone another way, even though Pen insisted the creature would return to search the only area they could reasonably be expected to cover on foot. Cinnaminson might attempt to steer it away from them, but it would know approximately where to look, no matter what she said. So far it hadn't appeared, however, and Kyber was growing impatient. And cold. Without her cloak to keep warm, she was shivering. This whole journey had been a disaster as far as she was concerned, but she was the one who had encouraged it, insisting that Uncle Arryn take them all under his druid's wing and bring them in search of the tree that would give Pen entrance into the forbidding. She was the one who had said they had an obligation to help the Ard Ris. She felt her throat tighten, and her eyes filled with tears as she thought of Arryn Elesadil, dead in the slags, her mentor, her surrogate father, her best friend, gone, killed by another druid. Druids at war with druids. It was an abomination. She had wanted so badly to be one of them, but now she wasn't sure. Arryn was dead. Grian Ohmsford was locked in the Forbidding, and the very order she had so desperately wanted to join was responsible for all of it. She had learned a little of how to employ elemental magic, but so far it hadn't proved very useful. She carried the elf stones, but they weren't really hers. In plain language, she was a rank amateur, a thief, and a runaway, and she was risking her life to achieve something she wasn't sure she believed in. She gave vent to her disappointment and despair, crying silently, keeping her face turned away from the other two so as not to wake them. She stopped after a few moments, deciding she had been self-indulgent enough, and composed herself. She could not afford to waste time. The decision had been made, the journey had been undertaken, and there was no turning back. She had believed rescuing the Ard Ris was the right thing to do when she had started out, and nothing had changed. The loss of her uncle was staggering, but she knew that if he were there, he would tell her not to give up, to remember what was at stake, to be brave, and to trust in what her instincts and common sense told her was true. He had come through worse on the voyage of the Jarl Shannara. He had found strength in recognition of his own failures and his ability to confront them. A boy, younger than she was now, he had remade himself into a man. She must do no less for herself if she was to be deserving of his trust. Absorbed in her thoughts, she very nearly missed seeing the sleek, dark shape of the Skatalo as it appeared on the horizon and turned toward them.
"Pen!" she hissed frantically. "Tagwin!"
They jerked awake, the dwarf starting so violently that he nearly rolled off his perch. She seized his shoulder to steady him, then pointed out to where the airship sailed through the starlit sky like a dark phantom.
"That's her," Pen whispered.
"I'm going down," Kyber announced, climbing to her feet. "Don't forget. Once you see that thing leave the airship, move into the trees, even if it brings Cinnaminson into the rocks, Pen, no matter what."
She didn't hear his response, if he gave one, and she didn't look back at him. She couldn't worry about him anymore. He was going to have to do his part, just as she was going to have to do hers, and that meant he was going to have to put all thoughts of Cinnaminson behind him. She wasn't sure he could do that, but it was out of her control. Her heart was beating rapidly, and her face felt flushed as she hurried through the maze toward the fire, blood singing through her veins. She forced herself to focus on the task ahead, picturing herself flinging the tar ball at the creature, imagining it coated in black goo. She glanced skyward once or twice, but she was too deep in the rocks to see what was happening with the Skatalo. The creature hunting them had to have seen the fire. Patience, she told herself. It was coming. She reached the clearing and retrieved the tar ball from beside the fire. The tar was warm and pliable through its leafy wrapping, in perfect condition for its intended use. She turned back to her hiding place and stepped inside. The crevice was deeply shadowed and slightly elevated from the fire, and the three cloaked forms stretched out around it. She could see everything that might happen and not be seen herself. Moon and stars lit the open space, revealing the opening to the passageway through which the creature would enter the clearing, but the angle of the moon left her own hiding place in the rocks shadowed and dark. She hefted the tar in her hands and settled back to wait. If she had been a little more proficient with her magic, she might have floated the tar out over the entry point, as Arryn had taught her to do with a leaf, dropping it on the creature when it appeared. But that required skill and timing she did not yet possess, and she could not afford to miss on her one opportunity. Thinking of her inability to use her magic made her wish she had studied longer and harder when she'd had the chance, when Arryn was still there to teach her. Who would teach her now? There was only so much she could do for herself, and now no one in the druid ranks whom she could turn to, if she even got the chance to try. The minutes passed. The darkness was deep and silent, a sweeping shroud lying soft and gentle across the world. Nothing moved. The clearing remained empty. The longer she stood there waiting, the more certain she became that the whole plan was doomed to fail. The thing that hunted them was quick and agile. Her chances of actually hitting it were poor, and her chances of escaping afterwards were poorer still. She began to think of ways in which she could use her small magic to slow it down, something, anything she could do to get far enough ahead of it that it couldn't catch her. A cold certainty began to creep through her that she didn't possess the necessary tools. She was just learning magic, just beginning to make the sort of progress that would lead her to a command of real power. Maybe she could use the elf stones. Maybe the thing was possessed of magic after all. They had been referring to it as creature rather than human being all along. It certainly looked to be so from the brief glimpses they had caught of it in an Atere. So maybe the stones would work against it. Or she could try summoning the wind that she had used to sweep it off the deck of the Skatalo. The wind had worked once. There wasn't any reason it shouldn't work again. That was a magic she could safely command. That was a weapon she could put to use. She waited some more. The minutes dragged by. The creature did not appear.
Something was wrong. It had been too long. It should have been here by now, if it was coming. She hated that she couldn't see what was happening beyond the clearing. It left her blind and helpless to do anything but stand there and hope they had guessed right about what the creature would do. But what if they hadn't? Her eyes scanned the clearing, probing the passage opening at the far side. Still, nothing moved. Then, a soft scrape sounded right above her hiding place, and a small shower of dust descended in a tiny cloud. Her breath caught in her throat. It was right above her. She froze, caught off guard completely. Right above me.
Did it know she was there? She waited, trying to regain control of her muscles, listening to the silence, anticipating so many bad possibilities that she wanted to scream to relieve the tension. Then she saw it, creeping along the rim of the rocks to her right, circling the clearing like a big spider, cloaked and hooded, as silent as the dark into which it had blended so easily. She realized at once the mistake they had made. They had assumed it would come at them on the ground because that's what they would have done in its place. But the thing wasn't like them. In a naturae, it had used the rooftops. Aboard the Skatelo, it had hung from the rigging. It liked the advantage of height. It had used it here, coming into the maze, not through the twisting passageways, but over the tops of the boulders, leaping and crawling like the insect it resembled.
Do something!
It was still moving, slowly and just a few yards at a time, studying the fire and the bundled forms. It might have sensed something was wrong, or it might simply have been making sure it wasn't missing anything. Whatever the case, if she was going to use the tar, she had to do it while the thing was still within striking distance. It would see her the moment she moved, of course. She would have to step out from her hiding place, and it would see her. She realized suddenly that this wasn't going to work. She wouldn't be fast or accurate enough. It could drop down on those rocks much faster than she could move. It was looking for a trap, and it would spot her the moment she left the shadows. What else can I do? The question echoed in her mind in a hopeless wail of despair. Then, all at once, the creature wheeled about, looking off to the south, toward the trees below the meadow, toward the path that Penn and Tagwin were already surely taking to reach the Skatelo. It froze in place, tensed and staring. A second later it was gone, bounding over the rocks and out of view, moving so swiftly that it seemed simply to disappear. She stood staring after it for a second, realizing what it intended, immobilized by her sense of failure and helplessness to prevent it from succeeding. She was too far away to reach them, too far away to get back to where they were. There was only one chance. Breaking from her hiding place in a rush, she raced across the clearing and through the passageway that led out to the meadow and the airship. After Kyber Elisadil disappeared into the rocks, Penn sat with Tagwin and watched as the Skatelo moved steadily closer to their hiding place and then finally started to descend toward the meadow. Even with the bright moon and stars to aid him, he could not make out what was happening aboard the airship. As the vessel landed, he searched for Cinnaminson and her captor without success. A cold premonition began to seep through him that it was too late for her, that the thing that had taken her prisoner had decided she was not worth the trouble. His premonition was not eased when he saw the shadowy form of the creature slide over the side of the vessel to tie her off and then start toward the rocks in a skittering crawl.
"We have to go, Penderin," Tagwin nudged him.
He took a moment longer to scan the decks of the Skatelo for any sign of the girl, but all he could make out were the desiccated forms of Gar Hatch and his crew still hung from the rigging. He swallowed and forced himself to look away. "She'll be all right," he told himself. "It won't have done anything to her yet, not this quickly." But his words sounded hollow and false.
They descended from their hiding place in a crouch, staying back from the light and any view from the meadow. Penn glanced through the rocks only once to make certain the creature was still heading toward the fire, caught a glimpse of its dark, skittering form, and turned his concentration to the task at hand. It took them a few minutes to get through the back end of the maze and down to the forest edge, where they could begin to make their way out to the meadow. They moved swiftly then, anxious to reach the airship and take control of her. The moonlight brightened their way, and they made good progress skirting the tree line, but their path was circuitous, and it took them longer than Penn had thought it would. The minutes seemed to fly by, and still they hadn't reached the opening between the trees and rocks that would get them out onto the flats.
"Do you hear anything?"
he whispered to Tagwin at one point, but the dwarf only shook his head. Finally, the meadow came into view ahead of them, its grasses silver-tipped and spiky in the moonlight. They began to move away from the maze, but still Penn couldn't see the Skatalo. He glanced toward the rocks, catching a quick glimpse of the fire's orange glow rising from their midst, dull and smoky against the darkness. The creature must be all the way in by now, but he still hadn't heard anything. Any minute, Kyber would throw the tar into its face. They had to move faster. They had to get to Cinnaminson.
"Tagwin,"
he whispered again, looking back to catch the other's eye, beckoning him to hurry. He was just turning away again when he caught sight of a spidery shape leaping across the boulder tops and coming toward them with frantic purpose. At first, he didn't comprehend what he was seeing. Then he let out a gasp of recognition.
"Tagwin!"
he shouted.
"Run!"
They bolted ahead, galvanized by the boy's frantic cry, the dwarf not yet fully understanding what had happened, but accepting that it was not good. They tore down along the tree line and into a vale that fronted the meadow. In the distance, the Skatalo was visible, silhouetted against the skyline, dark and silent. Penn turned toward it, taking a quick glance sideways into the rocks as he did so. The creature was still coming for them, moving swiftly across the crest of the maze, leaping smoothly and easily from boulder to boulder, closing the distance between them with frightening ease.
"It's too close," Penn thought in horror. "It's coming too fast."
"Faster, Tagwin!"
he cried. The dwarf had seen the creature as well and was running as fast as his stout legs could manage, but he was woefully slow and already falling behind. Penn glanced back, saw his companion dropping away, and slowed. He wouldn't leave Tagwin, not even to save himself. He reached for his knife, readying himself.
"Where is Kyber?"
Its cloak billowing behind it like a sail, the creature leapt from the edge of the rocks to the open ground, landing in a crouch that only barely slowed it as it came at the boy and the dwarf on all fours. Crooked limbs akimbo, head lowered within its concealing hood, it rushed them in a scuttling sideways charge.
"Penn!"
Kyber screamed in warning, appearing abruptly out of the maze, rushing into the meadow and turning toward them. Then a huge, dark form catapulted out of the trees behind them, a blur of gray and black that rippled and surged like the darkest ocean wave. Hugging the ground in a long, lean, shadowy flow, it intercepted the creature so quickly that it was on top of it before the other knew what was happening. With shrieks that caused the hair on the back of Penn's neck to stand straight up, the two collided and went tumbling head over hind quarters through the long grass. Roars and snarls and a terrible high-pitched keening followed as both scrambled up, clots of earth and grass flying in all directions.
"Bandit!"
Penn breathed in disbelief, the name catching in his throat as the massive moor cat's masked face wheeled into the light, muzzle drawn back, dagger teeth gleaming. The creature was up as well, and moonlight flashed off a strange knife held in one gnarled hand, its blade as silver as the crest of waves caught in sunlight, its edges smooth and deadly. In the glow of moon and stars, Penn could see it clearly, and he knew at once from its unnatural brilliance that it was a thing of magic. Bandit never hesitated. Enraged by whatever animal instincts the creature had provoked, determined to see the thing torn apart before backing away, it closed on its enemy with a scream that froze Penn's blood. In a knot of rippling fur and billowing cloak, the antagonists tumbled through the grass once more, locked in a death grip that neither would release. "Bandit!" Penn cried out frantically, seeing the knife flash as it rose and fell in short, choppy thrusts.
"Run, Pendaren!"
Tagwin shouted at him, pulling on his arm for emphasis.
"We can't wait!"
The boy obeyed, knowing there was nothing he could do to affect the battle between the creature and the moorcat. Remembering Cinnaminson, he tore his eyes away from the struggle. With Tagwin panting next to him, he raced for the Skatalo. Bandit had been following them all this time, he thought in wonder. Had the moorcat come into the high country solely because of their chance meeting and his few halting attempts at communication? He couldn't believe it. Behind him, he heard grunts and gasps, snarls and spitting, sounds of damage inflicted and damage received. They were almost to the airship when he forced himself to look back again. The creature was staggering after them, coming as swiftly as its damaged limbs could manage, its cloak shredded. Bandit lay stretched on the ground behind it, unmoving. Damp, glistening patches of blood coated its still body. Tears filled his eyes, and the boy made himself run even faster. Kyber was already aboard the airship, hacking at the anchor ropes with her long knife, freeing the vessel of her moorings. Penn climbed the ladder so fast he couldn't remember later whether his feet had even touched the rungs. His eyes searched everywhere. There was no sign of Cinnaminson. "Get us out of here!" Kyber screamed at him. "It's coming!" Penn leapt into the pilot box, fingers flying over the controls. He unhooded the diapson crystals as an exhausted Tagwin tumbled onto the deck, gasping for breath. Kyber cut away the last of the anchoring lines. On the plains below, their pursuer was closing on the ship in a terrible, hobbling rush, the bloodied knife lifted into the moonlight, a low wail that sounded like a dog in pain rising from the dark opening of its hood. Penn threw the thruster levers forward, feeding power to the parse tubes, and the Skatalo lurched and began to rise. They were too slow. The creature caught the low end of the rope ladder with one hand and held on, lifting away with the airship. "Tagwin!" Penn cried out frantically. The dwarf heaved to his knees, looked over the side, and saw the dark thing below, one hand gripping the ladder, the other the strange knife. Grunting with the effort, he began yanking on the brace of wooden pins that held the ladder in place. Below, the creature swayed in the wind, got a better grip on the rope, and began to climb. One of the pins came free, and Tagwin threw it aside. The ladder dropped to an unnatural angle, and the creature spit out something so terrifying that for a moment the dwarf froze in place. "Tagwin, the other pin!" Kyber howled at him, crawling across the listing deck. The creature had both hands back in place now and was climbing swiftly. At what might have been the last possible moment, the elven girl shouted out something in elfish and flung out both hands in a warding gesture. The last pin erupted from its seating in an explosion of wooden splinters and flew off into the night. The rope ladder and the creature fell away without a sound. Tagwin and Kyber peered over the side, searching. The landscape below had turned to forest and hills that were dark and shadowy. There was no sign of the creature. In the meadow farther back, Bandit's still form was a dark stain on the silvery grasses. As soon as they were safely airborne and the airship was flying at a steady rate of speed, Pen asked Tagwin to take over the controls.
Just keep her sailing as she is and you won't have any trouble. I have to take a look below.
Tagwin nodded without comment.
I can go with you, Kyber offered quickly. It might be better.
Pen held up his hand to stop her from saying any more.
No, Kyber. I need to do this by myself.
Without looking at her, he climbed out of the pilot box and walked to the rear hatchway. The door was open, and moonlight brightened the stairs leading down into the shadowed corridor below. All he could see in his mind was Bandit's blood-stained body, an indelible image that dominated every possibility he could imagine for Cinnaminson's fate. He purposely had not looked again on the corpses of Gar Hatch and his crewmen, trying to hold himself together against what he might find. He paused at the top of the stairs, listened to the silence, then took a deep breath and started down. At the bottom of the steps, he stopped again, peering ahead into the gloom. Nothing moved. No sound reached his ears. He fought back against the panic rising inside, determined not to give way to it. He moved ahead cautiously, the sound of his own breathing so loud that it felt as if every other possible sound was blocked away. At each door, he paused long enough to look inside before continuing on. There was no one in the storerooms or sleeping chambers that the members of the little company had occupied on their journey out of Sionid. The door to the captain's quarters stood ajar at the end of the corridor. It was the only place left to look. Pen couldn't decide at this point if he wanted to do so or not. He couldn't decide which was worse, knowing or not knowing. He pushed the door open and stepped through. Shadows cloaked the chamber in layers of blackness, concealing and disguising in equal measure. Pen stared around blindly, searching the inky gloom. Then he saw her. She lay stretched on the bed, bound, hand and foot with ropes and chained to the wall. Her face was turned away, and her pale blonde hair spilled across the bedding like scattered silk.
Cinnaminson, he whispered.
He went to her quickly, turned her over, and took away the gag that covered her mouth. Cinnaminson, he repeated more urgently this time. Her milky eyes opened, and she exhaled softly.
I knew you would come, she whispered.
On deck, Kyber stood next to Tagwin in the pilot box. She had thought to take down the bodies of the rovers, then decided to leave that job for later. The night air was cool and clear, and it felt good on her face as the airship sailed the feather-soft skies.
You should go see if he's all right, Tagwin said.
She shook her head, brushing away strands of her dark hair.
I should stay right where I am.
I don't hear anything, do you?
She shook her head a second time.
Nothing.
They were silent again for a moment. Then Tagwin said,
Did you see what happened back there in the meadow?
She nodded.
I saw. I don't understand it, though. That cat must have tracked us all the way out of the slags. Why would it do that? Moor cats don't like high country like this. They don't ever come up here. But that one did. Because of Pen, I think. Because of the way he spoke to it back there, or how he connected to it, or something.
Tagwin snorted.
That's not the strangest part. It's what happened afterwards, when it attacked that creature. It gave up its life to save the boy. To save all of us. Why would it do that?
She touched the controls lightly, fingering without adjusting, needing to make contact with the metal.
I don't know.
She glanced over at him.
Maybe Penn's magic does more than he realizes. If it moved that cat the way it seems to have, It isn't just a way of communicating or of reading behavior.
Doesn't seem so.
Again they fell silent. Ahead, stars filled the horizon with diamond-like brilliance, myriads spread across the dark firmament, numbers beyond imagining.
I don't think we killed it, she said finally.
Tagwin nodded slowly.
I don't think so either.
It will come after us. It won't give up.
I don't suppose it will.
She looked out into the night. It's probably already tracking us. Tagwin snorted and rubbed at his beard, irritably.
I hope it has a long walk ahead of it.
Pen could feel Cinnaminson trembling as she told him the story.
They caught us coming back across the slags. They were in a druid ship, the Gallifile, and they snared us with grappling hooks and came aboard. One of them was a dwarf. I could tell by his voice and movements. He wanted to know where you were, what we had done with you. Papa was terrified. I could feel it. I knew from what had happened in the swamp how frightened he was of them. He didn't even try to lie. He told them he had abandoned you after finding out who you really were. He gave them your descriptions and identities. I couldn't do anything about it.
She took a deep breath and pressed him closer.
I couldn't do anything about any of it, she whispered and began to cry again.
He had freed her hands and feet, and he was sitting with her on the bed, holding her, stroking her hair, waiting for her to stop shaking. He let her cry now, knowing she needed the release, that it would help to calm her. She seemed to be all right physically, but emotionally she was close to collapse.
They left as soon as they got directions from my father on where to find you. The other one must have come aboard while this was happening. We never saw it until they left, and then, all of a sudden, it was there. It didn't say anything, and we couldn't see who it was wrapped in that cloak and hood. It didn't look or move like a human, but I think it is. It spoke to me a few times, a strange voice, hoarse and rough, like someone talking through heavy cloth. I don't know its name. It never gave it.
He touched her face. We dropped whoever it was over the side of the Skatelow as she was rising. We tricked it off, and it was trying to get back aboard, but we managed to cut the ladder loose as it was climbing up. I think it might be dead. She shook her head at once, her face rigid with terror.
It isn't dead. It isn't. I would know. I would feel it. You haven't spent 3 days with it like I did, Pindarin. You haven't felt it touch you. You haven't heard that voice. You haven't been through what I've been through. You don't know.
He pressed her close again. Tell me, then. Tell me everything.
It made us prisoners. I don't know how it managed, but I never heard anything. No one even had a chance to struggle. I was locked away below, but I heard everything. It tortured Papa and the others, and then it killed them. It took a long time. I could hear them screaming, could hear the sounds of...
She broke off, gasping.
I'll never forget. Never. I can still hear it.
Her fingers were digging into Penn's arms. She took a deep breath.
When it was over, the
thing came for me.
I thought I was next, but it knew about my sight, about how I could see things in my mind. That was what it wanted. It told me to find you. I was so afraid that I did what I was told because I didn't want to die. I did everything right up until I found you. And then I turned us another way. I don't know why. I don't know how I found the courage. I thought I was dead then.
We saw you lead it away, Pen whispered.
We knew what you had done, so we came after you. If you hadn't...
She shuddered once and began to cry again.
I can't believe Papa is gone.
Pen thought of Gar Hatch and his cousins hanging from the rigging like scarecrows, food for scavengers. He'd have to cut them down and dispose of them before she was allowed on deck. Maybe she couldn't see with her eyes, but she could see in other ways. He didn't want that to happen.
Tell me what this is all about, she whispered. Please, Pen. I need to know why Papa's gone.
Penn told her, starting at the beginning with the disappearance of the Ard Reese, detailing his own flight west to find Aaron Elisadil and their journey before they had found Gar Hatch and the Skatelo. He told her how he had come to be in this situation, what he was expected to do, and why, and where they were heading now. He confided his doubts and fears to her, admitted his sense of inadequacy, and revealed his reasons for continuing on nevertheless. As he spoke, she stopped shaking and grew quiet in his arms. Her horror of what had happened seemed to drain away, and the calmness he had been awaiting settled over her. When he was finished, she lifted her head from his shoulder.
"You are much braver than I am," she said. "I am ashamed of myself."
He didn't know what to say.
"I think we take our courage from each other."
She nodded and closed her eyes.
"I want to sleep a while, Penn. I haven't slept in 3 days. Would it be all right if I did?"
He covered her with blankets, kissed her on the forehead, and waited for her to fall asleep. It only took a few minutes. He stood looking down at her afterwards, thinking that finding her alive was the most precious gift he had ever received, and he must find a way to protect it. He had lost her once. He would not do so again. His resolve on that point would be tested at some time, he knew. What would he do when that happened? Would he give up his life for her as Bandit had for him? Did he love her enough to do that? There was no way to know until he was faced with the choice. He could tell himself anything, make any promise he wished, but promises were only words until more than words were required. He paused at the doorway and stared into space. He knew how much she would depend on him. She would need him to be there for her. But that worked both ways. Because of how he felt about her, he depended on her to be there for him, too. He might be only a boy, and she even younger than Kyber, but that didn't change the truth of things. They would need to be strong for each other if they were to keep each other safe. He closed the door softly behind him as he went out. Chapter 5. The day's heat still clung to the foothills below the Ravenshorn, sultry and thick in the waning of the afternoon light, when Rue Meridian said in a surprised voice, "That looks like an airship coming toward us." Beck Ohmsford turned and caught sight of the black dot out on the western horizon, backlit by the deep glow of the setting sun. Even though he wasn't sure what he was looking at, he took her at her word. Her eyes had always been better than his. He glanced at her admiringly. He couldn't help himself. He still loved her as much now as he had when he had met her some 20 years earlier. He had been just an impressionable boy back then, and she, older by several years and a good deal of life experience. A woman. Circumstances and events had contrived to make falling in love the inevitable result of their meeting, and all these years later, that surprised him still. She remained strong and beautiful, undiminished in any way by time's passing, a rare and impossibly wondrous treasure. Blessed with dark red hair and bright green eyes, a tall, rangy body, and a personality that was famously mercurial, she constantly surprised him with her contradictions. Born a rover girl, she had flown airships with her brother, fought on the Preken Doran, journeyed to the then unknown continent of Parcasia, and returned to marry and stay with a man whose world was so different from hers that he could not begin to measure the gap between them. She might have chosen another way, something closer to the life she had abandoned for him, but she had not done so, nor voiced a moment's regret. As wild and free as her life had been, it seemed impossible to him that she had given it up, but she had done so in a heartbeat. Together, they had settled in Patch Run and started their airship exploration business. They had wanted a son, and one had been born to them within the first year. Pendaren to her, Penn to him, Little Red to his footloose rover uncle, Redden Altmare. He was everything they had hoped for. Having Pen in her life changed Rue noticeably, and all for the good. She became more grounded and settled. She found greater pleasure in her home and its comforts. Always ready to sail away, she nevertheless wanted time with her baby, her son, to prepare him to face the larger world. She taught him, played with him, and loved him better than anyone or anything but Beck. As a consequence, Beck loved her better as well. She caught him looking at her and smiled. "I love you too," she said. Bound to each other initially by the experiences they had shared during their journey aboard the Gerald Shannara, they discovered that they also shared an important similarity in their otherwise disparate backgrounds. Both had lost their parents young. Beck had been raised by Corin and Lyria Lee, Quentin's parents, and Rue by her brother. It was their mutual decision that Penn would know his parents better than they had known theirs. From the beginning, it was their intention that he should share in all aspects of their life together, including their business. He became a part of it early, learning to fly airships, to maintain and repair them, to understand their components and the functions they served. Penn was a quick study, and it was no stretch for him to master the intricacies of navigation and aerodynamics. By the time he was 12, he was already designing airships as a hobby. By the time he was 14, he had built his first vessel. He wanted to fly with them on their trips, of course, but he was not yet ready for that. It was a source of great disappointment to him, but he was young, and disappointments didn't last. Beck shaded his eyes with his hand to cut the glare of the setting sun. He was of medium height, not as tall as she was, but broader through the shoulders, his hair and eyes dark, and his skin browned by the sun. Always quick and agile, he was nevertheless beginning to feel the inevitable effects of sliding into his middle years. His less than perfect eyesight, he thought, was the first indication of what lay ahead. "I think that's a druid ship," Rue said quietly. He peered at what was now definitely identifiable as an airship, but he still couldn't tell what sort it was. What would a druid airship be doing out here? She glanced at him, and he could tell that whatever she was thinking, it wasn't good. They were miles into the central Anar, in wilderness that few ventured into who weren't in the trapping, trading, or exploration business. The Ravenshorn Mountains were mostly unsettled and infrequently traveled other than by the gnome tribes that called them home. A druid airship so far out would be coming for a very definite purpose, and on business that couldn't wait. Beck looked at their passengers, who were sitting around a map talking about where they wanted to go next. Two from the Borderlands, three from the Deep Southland, and a dwarf. All had signed on to see country that they had only heard about. They were 5 weeks out of Patch Run, where Beck and Rue had begun a series of stops to pick up their customers and take on supplies. They had 3 weeks left in the Eastland before they started back. "Your sister?" Rue suggested, nodding toward the airship. He shook his head. "I don't know. Maybe." He didn't want to voice what worried him most. One of the reasons a druid airship would come for them was that something had happened to Penn. Word would reach Grianne, and she would come to tell him herself. But he wouldn't let himself think like that, not just yet. This probably had something to do with the Ard Ris, or the State of the Four Lands. They kept watch as the airship sailed toward them through the fading afternoon sunlight, moving unerringly toward their campsite. How it had located them was a mystery, since few knew of their intended destination. A druid could find them with help, but only Beck's sister possessed sufficient magic to track them with no help at all. He could see now that it was indeed a druid airship that approached, so he began to suspect that she was aboard. The other members of the expedition had seen the ship and come over to stand with their guides. A few asked what she was doing there, but Beck just shrugged and said he had no idea. Then he asked them to move back into the campsite and closer to where Swift Shore was anchored, a precaution he would have taken in any event. "Are you expecting trouble?" Rue asked him, cocking one eyebrow. No, I just want to be ready.
We're always ready, she said.
You are, at least.
She smiled. That's why you were attracted to me, don't you remember?
The big airship eased out of the sky to the grassy shelf that fronted the encampment and overlooked the woodland country west. Anchor lines were dropped fore and aft, and a rope ladder was thrown over the side. Beck recognized the Athabasca, one of four ships of the line in the Druid fleet, capable of great speed and power. He was impressed by her look, but not even a Druid ship could match the speed of Swiftsure. A Druid began to climb down the ladder, dark-robed and hooded, swaying unsteadily as he carefully placed one foot below the other. A big man, Beck saw, powerfully built and strong, but unfamiliar with airships and flying. He stepped off the ladder, pulled back his hood to reveal his face, and started toward them. Beck had never seen him before, but then most of the Druids at Paranor were unfamiliar to him. Except for his sister and Arran Elisadil, who was no longer at Paranor, he had met only one or two others over the years, and those he barely remembered. The Druid life was his sister's life, not his, and he had kept himself deliberately apart from it. Sometimes he felt badly that he was not doing more to help her in her work, but it was not work he had ever cared to involve himself in, and so he thought it better not to pretend he did. The man who approached was younger than they were, though not by much, and his careworn face suggested he might be aging in other ways. Their lives filled with secrets, their work clandestine and often unknowable, Druids always troubled Beck. It was a role that fit his sister well, the clothes of her life as the Ill's Witch, where she had perfected the art of subterfuge and dissembling. Such skills were necessary in the world of the Druids, even though intended for good and not for evil. Druids were not well liked in the Four Lands. It was not a prejudice he shared, understanding them as he did, but it was a fact of life. Power fostered fear, and fear, mistrust. The Druid Order was for many the genesis of all three. "Aren't those gnome hunters crewing the Athabasca?" Rue asked suddenly. "Where are the trolls?" It was too late for speculation.
"Beck Olmsford?" the Druid asked as he came up to them.
He held out his hand without waiting for a reply.
"My name is Trant Rowan."
He shook Beck's hand, then took Rue's as well. His grip was firm and reassuring. He spoke in even, measured tones that radiated sincerity and concern.
"I was sent by the Druid Council to bring you back with me to Paranor," he continued, looking at them in turn. "The Ard Rhys has disappeared. We don't know what happened to her, but she's gone, and we haven't been able to find out why."
Beck nodded. His sister had disappeared before, many times. She was known for going off without warning on undertakings she wished to keep secret.
"You must have reason to be worried about her beyond what you've told me.
She has gone her own way without advising others many times in her life. Why is this time any different?"
"Her personal assistant, Tagwin, always knows where she is, or at least he knows when she is leaving. This time he didn't know anything about what happened, nor did the troll guard. No one did. This is where matters become a bit more complicated. Tagwin was concerned enough that he sought out Arran Elisadil to help search for her. Together they traveled to Patch Run to find you, but they found you gone and spoke with your son instead. When they left, they took him with them. Now we can't find any of them."
Beck felt a stab of fear. Rue's fingers reached out to find his and tightened sharply. "How did you find all this out? You haven't received any messages, have you?"
The Druid shook his head. "None. We found out what we did by asking those who knew bits and pieces of the truth. Tagwin left word where he was going. We followed him to the Westland village of Emberin. We discovered that he spoke with Arran Elisadil and that they left together. From there, we tracked them to Patch Run, but we don't know what happened after that. We only know that your son is gone as well."
He grimaced.
"I'm embarrassed we don't know more. We have been searching for them for days. We have been searching for you, too.
We think that the disappearance of the Ard Ris might indicate that her entire family is in danger. There is some indication of this being so. She has many enemies, and everyone knows you are close to her and are possessed of the Shannara magic as well. Some of those enemies might consider you as dangerous to them as she is. Pendaren would never go off with anyone, even Aran Elisadil, without leaving word for us, Rue broke in suddenly. Did you look for a message?
We did, Trant Rowan said. We looked everywhere, but we didn't find one.
You searched our house, Beck thought. That was bold. Why did you feel the need? If Penn failed to leave a message, it was because he didn't have enough time to do so. Rue was sliding into a protective mother role, and Beck could see the anger in her eyes. Why wasn't he offered your protection earlier? A flicker of irritation appeared on Trant Rowan's handsome face, and then quickly disappeared.
We did what we thought best at the time. We were a little disorganized, confused. We didn't know what had happened at that point.
You still don't, it seems, she snapped.
The druid turned to Beck.
If you will return with me to Paranor, perhaps we can find them together. We know you have a strong connection to your sister, that you share the use of her magic. We were hoping that you might find a way to apply your talents to help us with our search. If we can find either your sister or your son, we have a chance of finding both.
He hesitated. I admit that we are growing desperate. We need a fresh approach. We need any help that we can get.
He sounded sincere, and his plea had merit, but something troubled Beck. He couldn't put his finger on what it was, but he couldn't quite make himself dismiss it either.
What of the expedition? He asked, trying to think it through.
I will see that everything is taken care of. Another ship, paid for by the Order, will fulfill your obligation to your passengers. With your permission, I will fly back with you aboard your airship to Paranor. The Athabasca can continue her search. We have all of our airships out looking, crisscrossing the four lands. I don't want to take any of them out of service until this matter is settled.
He paused.
We are doing everything we can to find your son.
He directed this last comment at Rue, in what was surely an effort to reassure her, but Beck was pretty certain it was too late for that.
We have to find him, Beck, Rue said quickly. We have to do whatever it takes.
She was right, of course, but that didn't mitigate his sense of uneasiness. Why would Penn, who was always so dependable, disappear without a word to anyone? Where would Aran Elisadil have taken him that required such secrecy? Looking at it from every conceivable angle, he kept coming back to the same two possibilities, that his son had been forced to flee, or that Trant Rowan was lying.
Let me talk with our passengers and tell them what's happening, he said to the druid. Then we'll come with you.
He took Rue's hand and led her over to where the six who had hired them were standing in the shadow of Swiftshore. Quickly, he told them a version of the truth, that an emergency had arisen that required them to leave immediately for home, that another airship, with another captain and crew familiar with expedition work, would come to allow them to complete their outing. There were a few disappointed looks, but everyone took it well. None of them asked for their money back. They shook hands and wished one another well. After giving a wave of reassurance to Trant Rowan, Beck walked over to the crates of supplies stacked on the ground at the airship's stern and began checking through them. Rue, who had hesitated before following him over, bent close.
What are you doing?
Pretending that I'm doing something useful, he said, gaining us a little space and time so that we can think. She joined him in poking through the crates, her eyes never leaving his face.
You don't trust him either.
He glanced back at the druid, who was leading their passengers over to the Athabasca in preparation for boarding. Why do you think Tagwin felt the need to seek out Aran Elisadil when there are more than 100 other druids at Paranor whom he could have turned to? Why would he choose to seek help outside Paranor's walls? That doesn't feel right.
No, she agreed, it doesn't.
But let's assume he had a good reason for traveling all the way to Emberon to find Aran. Why did Trant Rowan and the other druids suddenly feel a need to follow him? If they were worried about our family,
Why wouldn't they go straight to Patch Run to warn us? They've thrown Penn into the mix as a reason for their search, but they didn't know anything about a connection to us before they started looking for the other two. Rue's mouth tightened. He said Penn might be in danger, that we all might, but he never said from whom, did he?
I take your point.
Whatever the case, I don't think we are being told the truth. She straightened abruptly. Then why are we going back to Paranor? If this is some sort of trap, we shouldn't be so quick to step into it.
He shook his head. They want something from us. If they didn't, they would have taken a different approach. Besides, if we don't go to Paranor, we lose our best chance of finding out what is really going on.
She brushed back loose strands of her long red hair and looked off into the distance. I could make him tell us everything in about 10 minutes if you left me alone with him.
Beck smiled in spite of himself. He's a druid, Rue. He's too powerful to play games with. Anyway, if we scare him, he won't be so eager to tell us anything. Even when he lies, he gives us small glimpses of the truth. Let's make use of that for now. We can skin him and hang him out to dry later.
She reached over and took his hand. I want Pendaren safe, Beck. If this involves your sister, it probably involves her enemies, and her enemies are too dangerous for a boy to deal with.
She glanced over at the druid airship.
I hate it that we've become involved in her life again. He straightened and took her in his arms.
She let him do so, but her body remained stiff and angry as he held her.
Don't be too quick to blame this on Grian, he whispered. We don't know anything for sure yet. We don't even know that Penn is missing. All we know is what we've been told, and we can't really trust that.
She nodded and inclined her head into his shoulder. What if he's telling the truth? We can't dismiss that possibility either. Just because he hasn't told his story well doesn't mean it isn't true. We can't take chances with Penn's safety.
He pressed her against him reassuringly. Nothing will happen to Penn. Remember who raised him. He isn't without resources or skills. If he's disappeared, it may be because he wants it that way. What we need to do is to discover the reason, but we have to go to Paranor to do that. Are you willing to take the chance?
She backed out of his embrace, and he saw the familiar resolve reflected in her green eyes.
What do you think?
Chapter 6 Shadea Aru walked alone down the lower west corridor of the Druid's Keep, listening beyond the soft scrape of her footfalls for other sounds. The air was warm and stultifying outside the walls of the keep, but cool and resonant inside. A barely audible whisper of faraway voices reverberated off the stone walls like motes of dust dancing in the light. She listened to those voices carefully, but only to make certain they did not follow her. They would be serving the noon meal now, and a period of rest would follow for those who cared to take advantage of it. Few would. The druids she led knew there were consequences for any failure to complete their work. She kept them guessing as to what those consequences might be, or when to expect them. She let them work without supervision or deadlines because her unpredictability was all the incentive they required. A little uncertainty and a few object lessons were strong motivators. She did not visit acts of reprisal on those who disappointed her. She knew better than to do that. She did not use her office to punish outright. She had learned a long time ago that consequences must be administered in more subtle ways. A few well-chosen examples set the tone. She provided them early on, within days after gaining the position of Ard Rhys, a clear indication of her expectations. She chose two younger druids, ones lacking in broad support, ones whose presence would not be missed. She called them into her office and simply dismissed them. She sent them home without offering them even the smallest clue as to how or why they had failed. They might apply for reinstatement, she advised, once they had determined the nature of their shortcomings. It was a fair and just approach to the strict demands of the Order's disciplines, and no one could find fault with how she had handled things. Yet the underlying message was unmistakable. If one failed, whether one understood how or why, one paid the price. The best way to avoid such consequences was to work hard and not make trouble. Of course, the more powerful of the druids were not so easily intimidated. Their dismissal would result in confrontations of the sort she was trying to avoid. Yet she was determined that they all be brought into line, that they be made to accept her leadership and her control. She did not require that they make a public display of their loyalty. She needed only to know it was understood that she was Ard Rhys, in more than name. Hence, this clandestine meeting with the most powerful of those whose support she required. If Garen Sarah would agree to back her openly, if she could gain his support for her efforts, then the rest would be easier to persuade. The problem was that Sarah hated her almost as much as he had hated Grian Ohmsford. If she was to have any success in gaining his support, she must first find a way to change his feelings. She paused at the entry to a rotunda that served as a hub for a series of connecting corridors. Light from narrow slits cut high up in the circular walls reflected off the stone blocks. Measuring sticks for the single stairway that led upward to the west watchtower and its parapets. She had chosen this remote and private spot to test Sarah's resolve. If he feared to meet her there, alone and unprotected by his followers, he was not the ally she needed. If he appeared, it would reinforce her belief that he would serve the purpose she had set for him. She needed a fresh ally. Tarek Molt was dead. Iridia Illyri had abandoned Paranor, and Trant Rowan and Pison Wentz were beginning to show signs of vacillation. Though the latter two did her bidding, they failed to command the respect and fear of the dwarf and the sorceress. She was incensed about Iridia, who had simply disappeared after the death of her beloved Arryn Elysidil. But there was nothing Shadea could do about it. Searching for Iridia would consume time and resources. Worse, it would demonstrate weakness. Better to deal with her later. She thought fleetingly of Trant Rowan, who should by then have been deep in the Eastland and close to making contact with Beck Ohmsford and his wife. If he succeeded in bringing them to Paranor, she would have new leverage in her search for the boy and his companions, should the unthinkable happen and Aphasia Y fail. She would also have a means for reconfirming that Grian Ohmsford was safely imprisoned within the Forbidding, where she could cause no further harm. The brother's magic could be put to that use. It was dangerous to use him that way, but it was a risk she felt she had to take. When she was done with him, when she had hunted down the boy and verified that his aunt was dead and gone, it would be easy enough to dispose of the entire Ohmsford family. But first things first. She must concentrate on the task at hand, the manipulation of Garen Sarah. She glanced around the rotunda, their appointed meeting place. There was no sign of him.
"I am here, Shadea," he said from the shadows behind her.
She turned with a start. Tall and menacing in his black robes, he was standing just inside the same hallway she had come down. He must have followed her all the way to their meeting place, and she had not heard him do so. It was a clear demonstration of his skill, given so that she would not mistake his coming as an indication of weakness. It was typical of him. He had survived over the years by making certain no one ever misjudged what he was capable of doing. "Garen Sarah," she greeted him, holding her ground. He came up to her, lean and hatchet-faced, his nose and cheekbones narrow and chiseled, his mouth a thin line of disapproval. His expression was unreadable, as if his mind had emptied of thought and his heart of emotion. He was a formidable opponent, and there were few at Paranor who would dare to challenge him.
"Are we alone?" he asked.
He would already know the answer to that question, she thought. He only wanted to let her think he trusted her not to lie to him. "Of course. What I have to say to you is not meant for other ears."
"I didn't think so."
He glanced around, as if come for the first time to a new place.
"No one is likely to pass down these corridors, I suspect."
Nevertheless, we are too much exposed to suit my taste. We should not be seen meeting like this, even by accident.
She nodded. Come this way.
She led him into another of the passageways and from there into an unmanned guard room fronting the outer wall.
Here?
She asked. He nodded, and she closed the door behind them.
This should serve our needs.
He walked over to a bench set against the far wall and sat down.
Let me save you some time and effort, Shadea. You have summoned me because you require my help. Your own allies seem to be disappearing rather more rapidly than I think you anticipated in the wake of what's happened. Some won't be returning, I suspect. You are Ard Rhys in name, but your grip on the title is tenuous. Allies are necessary. I would be the one whose support you covet most. Am I right?
She was angered by his presumptions, but kept her feelings in check. He was right, of course. That was one of his strengths, the ability to analyze a situation quickly and accurately.
Your support would be welcome, she acknowledged.
His sharp features tightened.
Why should I give it to you?
I could suggest the obvious, that it would be safer for you to have me as a friend than an enemy. His smile was bitter.
You could never be a friend to me, Shadea. You could never be a friend to anyone you viewed as a potential rival. I accept that. I don't want you as a friend in any case. As well, I don't want you as an enemy. Your successful elimination of Grian Omsford demonstrates sufficient reason for that. Such an impressive piece of work, so unexpected. No one knows how you did it. Gone, almost as if she never existed. Care to explain how you managed it?
She shrugged. As you said,
you don't want me as your enemy.
So then, I can have you as neither friend nor enemy. Perhaps there is some middle ground?
Perhaps. Why don't we try to find it?
She walked over and sat down beside him, taking away the advantage of height to put them on an equal footing.
I do have need of your help. You have read the situation accurately. I have lost old allies. I need new ones. The Council follows me for now, but it may shift allegiance when the opportunity arises. I can do nothing to further the Druid cause until the problem is safely eliminated. Think what you want of me. But my goal in all of this is to make the Order stronger and more effective. Under Grian, we were wallowing in discontent and ineffectiveness. That has changed already, even in the few days she has been gone.
Garand Sarah arched one eyebrow.
How so?
I have gained the unqualified support of Sen Dunsedain and the Federation. That support goes beyond his openly professed acceptance of my stewardship of the Order. A deeper understanding has been forged, one that will eventually give us control over him.
He nodded slowly. He will crush the Freeborn, and you will have the Order stand by and let it happen. But how will you then gain control of him?
She smiled. What you need to know is that I do not intend to let things proceed in the disorderly fashion allowed by my predecessor. I intend to take action, and to take it now. I will change the course of history, and I will make the Druid Order the spearhead for that change.
How ambitious of you,
he said softly. I won't deny it. I am ambitious for both the Order and myself. You can join me in this effort, or you can continue to oppose me. If you join me, I will give you fresh standing in the Order, a chance to advance at my side, equal in almost everything.
He laughed. Until you no longer have need of me.
She held his gaze.
Or you of me?
They stared at each other in silent appraisal, each measuring the other's hidden intent against the possibility of truth contained in the words already spoken. The silence lengthened, and Shadea caught a hint of uncertainty in the other's black gaze.
An alliance, then?
He said.
A very close alliance. Personal as well as professional.
He stared at her.
You don't mean for us to become joined in that way, do you?
He asked softly.
She nodded slowly. Oh, but I do. Why not? Don't tell me it hasn't crossed your mind. It crosses every man's mind, sooner or later. I see how they look at me. I know how they think. I am offering myself to you. I understand the risk of doing so, of course, but there are always risks. What I seek is an open and obvious alliance that no one in the Order will dare to challenge.
Well, he said, pursing his thin lips, I didn't expect this. Do you find me so attractive?
She shrugged. Not in the way you might think. Attractive in a different way. Women and men don't always think alike about these things. Accept my offer, and I might even explain it to you one day. He stared at her without answering, looking directly into her eyes and searching for what she was hiding. She let him hold her gaze, patient and unflinching. You could move into my quarters, of course, she said. You could sleep with me or not, as you choose. What matters is that others see us as a couple. We would be seen as joined in all things, not necessarily by proclamation, but otherwise openly so. I am Ard Rhys, but you would be my shadow half. Your word would be mine. We would advance the cause of the Order together. He let his eyes drop to her body, then rose and walked away and stood looking at the wall.
I will not say I am not tempted. You understand me well enough to know I am. We both crave power in all its forms. Your submission would be immensely satisfying. But where does this lead? How does it end?
She laughed openly. Do you need to know in order to be persuaded, Garen Serra? Aren't you excited by the idea that neither of us can know how this will end? That it is a gamble we must accept? Life is risk. What is the point otherwise? He turned back to face her.
What of your other allies? How will they view this change of plans?
She shrugged. They will accept it. They haven't any choice. I am the one they answer to. She reached up to touch his cheek. And now to you as well, if you accept my offer.
He shook his head. You would dispose of me in an instant, discard me with not a second thought.
You would do the same with me, she countered. We do not fool each other in any way about this arrangement. We make use of it until it no longer suits us, and then we see how things stand. It does not necessarily have to end in killing. It can end in any number of other ways. Are you so committed to my death that you cannot imagine any other possibility? Do I appear no different to you than Grianne Ormsford did?
He smiled. You are different in more ways than I can count. I do not mistake you for her, but I do not mistake you for anything different from what you are either. I would have to watch my back constantly were I to accept your proposal.
She put her hands on his narrow shoulders and drew him a step closer. Oh, come now. What would be the purpose of making this offer if all I wanted was to see you dead? There are much less complicated ways to achieve that end. Once I have joined with you openly, it immediately becomes more difficult for me to dispose of you, doesn't it? Besides, what would be the reason? I need you alive and at my side if I am to achieve what I seek. You can see that, can't you?
His lean features showed nothing, impassive and unrevealing as she pressed herself close and kissed him on the mouth.
Can't you? Then he was kissing her back, and she knew she had him. Later that night, when the druids of Paranor were asleep or at work in quarters kept open for that purpose, the night fallen in a thick black veil through skies so clouded that neither moon nor stars could penetrate, she slipped from her bed to walk the empty corridors and think. She spared only a single glance back at the sleeping and sated Garen Serra before closing the door on him. Her seduction of her most dangerous enemy had been a success. It had even been enjoyable. She had not lied to him.
she found him attractive enough. His menacing look and poisonous mind drew her much the way she thought the Ill's witch must have felt drawn to snakes. They were treacherous by instinct and unpredictable by nature, and one could not trust what they would do because they frequently did not know themselves. But they were fascinating as well. She flushed with heat and passion, imagining how it would feel to hold one close to her breast and feel its deceptively silky skin sliding against her own. She slipped down the empty corridor outside her room, hugging the shadows as she moved to the stairwell that led upward into the central tower and the parapets that ringed it. She wore her nightgown, and nothing more. Disdainful of clothing, of armor and weapons, of trappings that hampered and slowed. She feared nothing in this world, so why should she care how she appeared or what she revealed? Convention and conformity were for others. She would be what she liked. For now, Garand Serra was hers. She knew he thought otherwise. He had taken her body and would think he had taken her mind in the bargain. He had allied himself with her so that he could gain a toehold on the steps of the office she warded. He was probably already planning how he would dispose of her. But she had known all that going in, had understood that he would accept her proposition only to get what he coveted most, the position she held. He would stay close to her so that he could more easily eliminate her. But that was a blade that cut both ways. Keeping him close allowed her the same opportunities. His plans for her were no different than hers for him. Yet the bargain favored her. She was the one who would be seen to have united the druids, to have pulled the two central factions together, so that there would no longer be bickering and dissatisfaction. She was the one who would be seen to have allowed common sense to prevail over pride. She was the one who would be seen as the real leader of the order, and Garand Serra, though he might claim otherwise, would be only the consort of the Ard Rhys. A consort, she had already decided, whose usefulness at Paranor would quickly run its course. She climbed to the tower and walked out onto the parapet. A wind blew chilly and brisk out of the west, but anxious to feel something cold against her skin, she let it wash over her without shivering.